Long ago we were considered superior to humans. I'm guessing you didn't know that. The term Mir comes from the word Maya, an old speech word that originally meant son of. It was also an honorific, like Sir, added before the name of a knight. If you put those two things together, you must conclude that we are descended from pretty good stock. It was only after the fall of Meridith, a province of the old empire that was governed by Mir, for Mir, that the term became derogatory. No offense, but all of that contradicts history as I understand it. That's because the history you know is wrong. History isn't truth. You're not too foolish to recognize that, are you? The dancers moved away as acrobats tumbled into the center of the square, encouraged by applause. Men in tight clothes jumped and rolled and climbed onto one another, creating human ladders of various designs. And how do you know your history isn't a lie? Royce asked. Mercator grinned. I'm older than I look. A lot older. That's one of the things about Mir. We live a long time. Not so much as elves, I suspect, but longer than humans. My mother lived to be 450. She could remember Glenmorgan and his Second Empire. Age gave her wisdom to conclude that our long life was a gift turned into a curse by a world filled with ignorant hate and bad timing. My grandfather, Sadarshakar Sikara, was born in 2051 and lived for 567 years. Can you imagine that? He remembered the birth of Nevrik, the heir of Novron, and the appointment of Venlin as the Archbishop of Persepolis. And he witnessed the fall of that grand city. He was in Meridith at the time, a province established for the Maiar, who chose not to live with humans. She leaned in, placed a hand to the side of her face, and whispered, "Rumor has it, the Maiar were a bunch of bigots." She laughed as if it was a joke, but Royce couldn't tell if it was ironic or just silly. If you're the descendant of such an esteemed family, why do you look so... Royce hesitated. Kalayan? Mercator glanced at her hands and nodded as if she'd expected the question. When Meridith fell to barbarians, Sadarshakar brought his family here to what was then called Alburnia. Few survived, and Sadarshakar took a Kalayan woman as his wife. The situation didn't improve, and my mother married a Kalayan man. Mercator drew back the shawl off her head and pulled on her nappy hair, which makes me, arguably, more Kalayan than Mir. A highly respected combination, I must say. She laughed again, managing to find humor in every tragedy. Royce could understand that, at least. Fact is, she said, I learned history from someone I trust, my grandfather, who witnessed the events firsthand. That's how I know. Tell me, Royce, is it? How do you know about the history of your people?
I actually don't care, Royce said. All of this clearly means a good deal to you, but it doesn't mean anything to me. Doesn't matter whether your version is true or not. I'm here to do a job, not debate ancient history. Now, if you want to talk about something, I'd love to hear where the Duchess is.
Mercator shook her head. Sorry, she's the only good card I still hold. But she's safe and unharmed, as this letter attests. I'd like to keep it that way. I've grown to like her. She's different.
It was worth asking, Royce said.
He gazed out at the plaza once more, trying to decide if he was pleased or irritated with the number of celebrating people. They complicated everything, which was both good and bad.
We probably... Roy saw movement where there shouldn't have been any. The plaza was still a swirl of activity. Dancers spun, acrobats tumbled, jugglers tossed, spectators clapped, and children ran. But overhead, nothing should have moved. Too dark for a bird, too big for a bat. Royce looked up at the front of Grumgalamus. The great doors were huge, but dwarfed by the massive bell towers on either side. Above those doors stood a row of sculpted figures of robed men. Then came the oculus of the great rose window. Next, a colonnade of pillars and arches, and above that, and still only halfway up, was a pediment upon which perched a series of gargoyles.
"What's wrong?" Maketa asked, craning her neck, trying to see what he saw.
"Thought something move." They both spotted it then. The third gargoyle from the left flexed its wings. "I'm not from here," Roy said. "Is that normal?"
"Of course not. It's... oh, no."
The gargoyle's head turned. Like so many others, this figure was monkey-like, with powerful, hunched shoulders, the wings and face of a bat, and saber-like fangs. As it looked down at them, Royce noticed that the eyes had been sculpted to look decidedly evil. But he guessed that was how he'd have seen them, regardless of what the artist had carved. Because the gargoyle looked right at him. Royce expected it to shove off the side of the cathedral, spread its wings, and dive. Instead, the beast began to climb down the front of the church, moving awkwardly at first, but gaining balance and skill as it descended, until it moved with monkey speed, leaping from pediment to column.
"Run!"
Maketa shouted at Royce. "Why did you kill Nim?" Griswold Dinge asked Hadrian. The dwarf sat across from him in the little room. With Nim dead, Ciri preparing for his funeral, Villar gone, and Maketa off to meet with the Duke, the dwarf, the last of the civic leaders, had apparently pulled guard duty. Hadrian was glad Erasmus Nim's widow wasn't there, as he was certain Seton's story didn't absolve him of that accusation. If anything, it cast more doubt. And he'd preferred to deal with an angry dwarf rather than a grieving widow.
"He didn't kill Erasmus," Seton affirmed faithfully.
The three sat cozy and close in the stone cellar, which was littered with rat droppings. Griswold had bound Hadrian's hands behind his back. As an added precaution, he held a naked dagger. His manner wasn't overtly threatening, but the menace was there. "She's right. I didn't kill the Calaean." Hadrian smiled, but his charm had no effect on the dwarf. "Oh, yes. Even though you were right on his heels during your pursuit, someone else came out of nowhere and took his life. Do you expect me to believe that?"
"I honestly have no idea what killed him," Hadrian said.
"Don't you mean who?" "Seemed more like a what. All I know is he was dead, and his face was gone. It looked like it had been chewed away. I only knew it was him because of the clothing and the box he had been carrying. Didn't seem like a typical murder to me."
"He didn't kill Nim," Seton asserted again.
"And how in the bloody name of all that is holy do you know that? He spared your life. So what? He also butchered a pile of men. You said so. Your own words show he's a killer. No innocent little lamb here. And his story about Nim missing his face is beyond belief."
"No, it's not," Seton said. "And it's not because he spared my life that I believe him."
This caught the dwarf's attention, and he turned, revealing a little gold earring piercing his left lobe.
Decoration? Mark of a sailor? Wedding gift?
Hadrian knew so little about the small folk that he felt not only stupid but ill-equipped to help himself, much less his cause.
"So, what makes you think he didn't kill Erasmus?"
"Killings where people are mutilated the way he described have happened before," Seton said. "That's the reason the nobles wear blue."
The dwarf shook his shaggy head.
"Bah! The nobles are skittish. The streets are dangerous. Not every person butchered in the alleys is a victim of...
I'm not talking about the recent murders.
Seaton's voice lowered and grew several degrees more serious. Her eyes supported the shift in tone, growing solemn. Hadrian found it odd to see so much darkness in a face that looked so young.
I'm talking about Throm Hodinel.
Griswold squinted his eyes.
Who now?
Throm Hodinel. He was the curator of the Imperial Gallery. Some said he was a relation to the Killians, a distant cousin or something. I saw his body the day they found it at the feet of the statue of Glenmorgan, and his face was a mess. They had to identify him by his clothing because...
Seaton hesitated, her eyes focusing on Hadrian, as if he knew the answer.
Because his face had been chewed off, he answered.
Seaton nodded.
Actually, it wasn't just his face. A large portion of the man had been eaten. But yes, his face was gone. So were a good number of his bones.
Sounds like wolves, Griswold said.
Inside the gallery.
The dwarf stared at her skeptically.
I've never heard this story.
It happened before your time.
The dwarf tilted his head and studied her more intently.
How old are you?
She grinned at him.
Throm Hodinel died 15 years before you were born.
This raised the bushy brows of the dwarf. Griswold looked to easily be in his 40s, maybe older. Seaton wasn't a teenager, wasn't human. And if what she said was true, she was decades older than Hadrian. Adding these truths to the embarrassing fact that he hadn't initially recognized her, Hadrian realized that while he had misjudged women before, this time marked a whole new level of stupidity.
Throm Hodinel wasn't the only one, Seaton went on. Every few years, someone dies the same way. It's almost always a noble, or someone suspected of being an illegitimate child of one of the old world dukes, usually male, and always within a few miles of Blythen Castle. The murders happen at night, or around dusk in a heavy fog, and in every case, the victims are eaten. Some are only eaten a little, others are almost completely devoured. But their face is always gone.
You're speaking about the Morgan. Villar told me that was a myth, the dwarf said.
Villar doesn't know everything.
Where is Villar? Hadrian asked.
Don't know.
He spoke the words slowly, not looking at either of them.
The statement caused the dwarf to frown, and his considerable brows knitted the equivalent of a full sweater.
Is something wrong?
Griswold looked up but didn't answer.
Griswold, what aren't you telling us?
Seaton asked.
Riots are a bloody business. If something went wrong, if our people were in jeopardy, we wanted protection. We needed a backup plan, so we could intercede, if necessary. But only if necessary.
Is that what the three of you were meeting about? Hadrian asked.
For the most part, yes. But I also needed to give Erasmus his supplies.
Hadrian nodded.
The box? I found it with Erasmus's body. But it only contained some rocks, just gravel.
The way he carried it, you'd think it was dangerous. In the hands of a skilled dwarf, dirt, stone, metal, and wood are all dangerous.
Hadrian felt that rope ought to be included on that list, as his wrists were starting to ache and his hands throbbed. In binding him, the dwarf had exhibited a level of skill that his people were known for when creating stonework or anything mechanical.
I don't understand, Seaton said.
Of course you don't. How could you?
It's old magic. Older even than you.
Older than Rochelle. Older than Novron.
What are you talking about?
Seaton asked.
Do you think only Mir hold the claim to ancient secrets? For all your age, our collective history goes back far beyond yours. Before Novron and his empire, before the Mir, before humans, the Belgriklungrians lived and thrived. I'm talking about the days when only full elves and dwarves roamed the lands, when Drumundor was the world's greatest forge. There was a time when we had a king, an age of greatness, an age of wonder. They say it was Advari, Birling, and King Midian who did it, but the magic predates even them. It goes back to the gods of the ancient giants, the ones known as Typhons. They were prohibited from having children of their own, according to legend, but they found a way to bring forth life from the earth and stone, a magic they used to create the giants themselves. My people discovered that secret, but because it was outlawed by the gods, it was forbidden. Only once it was attempted, and that was during the War of Elven Aggression, when King Midian saved our people. Elves had used their magic to crush the 10th and 12th legions on the plains of Mador. And then Midian called on the legendary Andvari Birling and asked him to crack the forbidden scrolls and to make a weapon that could defeat the elves. Some say Andvari never succeeded. Others claim he did, but that something went terribly wrong. They claim it was his failure, rather than the attack of the elves, that actually defeated the kingdom of Midian and laid waste to Linden Lot.
What did King Midian ask this Andvari to make?
Seaton asked. The only real magic our people ever had.
Which is?
Griswold paused a moment. Then a twinkle flickered in his eyes, and he leaned in and whispered, "A golem, a protector made of stone." No one in the plaza had noticed the gargoyle come to life. All eyes were on the acrobats, the dancers, or the juggler. Mercator nimbly raced through the oblivious crowd. For someone who claimed to be old, the Calaean Mere moved as well as the acrobats they dodged. She and Royce ran through the ring of dancers, breaking the chain of clasped hands, causing a disturbance. Like rambunctious children running through an adult party, they turned heads and provoked shouts. Royce was reminded of his youth. Fleeing had been a daily occurrence back when he survived by picking pockets in the squares of Ratibor. Just as wind was a bird's ally, crowds were his. They provided cover as well as opportunity. But just as too much wind could kill a bird, too dense of a crowd could jam him up, lock him in, and give his pursuer the chance to catch up. Being able to read a mass of people, to see the patterns and guess the timing, had made the difference between getting away and losing a hand. Royce was older now, and out of practice, but it didn't take long to rediscover the familiar skills and remember old techniques. Mercator did a fine job of finding and exploiting holes as well. Anticipating openings, she managed to stay out ahead. She looped the fountain, heading for the steps of the gallery. He wasn't sure what her plan was, but then Royce wasn't certain about the extent of the danger. Seeing a gargoyle come to life was disturbing, but the fact that Mercator felt the need to flee was the real worry. Why? Was something he could ask later. As it turned out, why was answered sooner than expected. People pointed at something behind Royce. Then the screams started, and finally he understood why Mercator was making for the steps of the gallery. The plaza was like a river where a dam had burst upstream. He needed to reach the safety of the bank before the rush of the flood. Whatever the gargoyle was doing, it had caused a panic, and the once happy crowd turned into a mindless mob as people began to push in a frantic attempt to get away. A man bowled over a woman and her daughter, causing him to trip and fall to the ground, where he, too, was stepped on.
The juggler and the dancers were consumed in the tidal surge.
Royce and Maqueda reached the marble steps of the gallery just as the wave burst. She wasted no time running to the big bronze doors.
Royce finally saw her plan and was once more impressed by the level of strategic forethought. And she was a Mere. If she knew, she could say the same about me, couldn't she?
The gallery wasn't as big as Grom Gallimus, but it was still large and almost entirely made of stone. There weren't any ground floor windows, and its doors opened out.
Royce and Maqueda would only have a few seconds to get inside.
The swell of the crowd fleeing whatever mayhem had ignited their stampede would realize what Maqueda had. The gallery was protection from this storm. If Royce and Maqueda were inside when that happened, the bottleneck would inhibit the gargoyle.
Brilliant.
Locked! Maqueda pulled angrily on the door. You can open it, right?
How'd you know?
Royce knelt at the door, making a quick study of the leather tumbler mechanism. Anyone expecting a severed finger seems the sort to have a background in theft.
Royce inserted his curtain pick into the keyhole. Lifting the lever, he popped the latch.
Although the process had taken only seconds, the crowd moved faster than Royce had expected. A mass of revelers turned stampeding herd pushed up behind them. Unable to pull the door open wide, the two barely managed to slip in before the pressing weight of the mindless crowd slammed it shut again. Part of Royce's cloak was caught, and he freed himself by ripping it in half.
The two looked back at the pair of bronze doors, backing slowly away, listening to the muffled cries of the terrified crowd that grew louder as the seconds passed.
The interior of the gallery was tomb quiet and dark, but Royce knew the building and remembered the room. He'd been there only the night before. This was the rotunda with the murals and paintings, odd artifacts on pedestals, and that big chariot with the stuffed horses yoked to it. The strange beast he'd seen from above, he now saw from level ground. This was the proper viewing position for everything, and from there, the dragon hoisted overhead was suitably terrifying.
"What is that thing outside?" Royce asked.
"A golem."
Maqueda's eyes remained fixed on the doors as the two backed away. The fear on her face did nothing to convince Royce that they were safe.
"Dwarven sorcery. Old, deep, evil magic."
"That thing was a statue a minute ago. What is it now?"
"Still a statue, in a way."
"It was after us, right?"
"Still is."
"Can it get in here?"
Maqueda looked up at the broken window in the upper colonnade, where the night before Royce had chased Vilar.
"I think so."
"Maybe you'd better tell me exactly what a golem is. I hate getting visits from total strangers."
Sitting in the chair was aggravating the pain in his arms, so Hadrian switched to the floor, where he could stretch out his legs. Seaton helped him, brushing away a pile of rat pellets.
"What does ancient dwarven magic have to do with you, Erasmus Nim, and Vilar?"
Griswold reached up and ran fingers under his beard, his lower lip jutting out. He paused there, and Hadrian thought he might not say anything.
"We doubted our forces would be enough to prevail against the Duke and the city guard. We needed more. We needed what Anvari offered King Midian."
"I'm guessing that's knowledge you can't pick up just anywhere," Hadrian said.
Griswold nodded and addressed Seaton.
"Do you know about the Night of Terror?"
"That was centuries ago," Seaton said.
Griswold scowled at her.
"And I suppose you were there."
"Before my time. Even before Mercator's, I think."
"One cold night, mobs came into Little Town. That's what they called our ghetto back then, and set our houses on fire. Everyone was dragged into the street for a beating. Almost 100 of my people died on the same night that the rest of the world calls Wintertide. Strange way to celebrate the rebirth of the sun, don't you think?
In the aftermath, the elders found a way to protect us. At that time, the city was under construction. Gromgalamus only half built. My people did the stonework. Cheap, skilled labour is what we were. The Archbishop commissioned many sculptures, and we were happy to oblige. Right under his nose, and with his blessing, we created weapons that we could call on in time of need.
Griswold smiled.
Surely you've seen all the fanciful downspouts and carvings, malevolent faces that spit rainwater out to the street.
Adrian nodded.
Those were our creations, every one of them sculpted by my people. We made them fierce and grotesque as a means of embodying what they are. Monsters. The Archbishop thought they were fanciful. Funny, he called them. What he didn't know was that each one was sculpted ritualistically, and the shards were saved so we could use them when necessary. If the day came when we were threatened again, we could breathe life into these decorations and send them to fight for us.
Griswold's glare hardened. The nobles have their soldiers, and we have ours. Ours sit upon their perches, high above the city, awaiting the day when all debts will be paid in full.
You can be really creepy. You know that? Adrian asked.
What exactly is a golem? Royce asked. Is it alive? Can it be killed?
I'm not an expert on dwarven magic, Makeda said. But I know golems are sculptures brought to life. Creatures that are supposed to retain the characteristics of the material they were made from.
This one is made from stone. Royce stared at the bronze doors with their detailed reliefs, 9 framed images that told the life story of a grand city. How do you harm stone?
Boom. Boom. Boom.
The gallery echoed with the sound of drumming on the doors by what could have been a huge hammer. They both watched as the elegant images were distorted by dents, the metal puckering where it was struck. Makeda and Royce backed up. Can't burn it. Doesn't have any blood, so slitting its throat is useless. Pretty much nothing sharp will be helpful. Royce was thinking out loud as he scanned the chamber for a weapon.
What is this place?
The Imperial Gallery, Makeda said, bumping into a bust of a balding man.
The sculpture toppled, fell, and shattered on the marble floor.
She stared aghast at the ruined artwork. The noble houses brought a lot of this stuff with them after the fall of Persepolis. They keep the best pieces in their homes, and the rest is displayed here.
I don't suppose there's an ancient weapon around that kills stone gargoyles.
Makeda flashed him a scowl that he guessed had more to do with the beating on the door than his poor attempt at humour. Hadrian would have appreciated it. Royce found a pair of hammers set on a display pedestal, one large, one small, both old and crude. He felt the weight of the heavy one, thinking it might be useful.
Why is it after us?
Makeda stared at the door.
It's being controlled by Vilar.
How do you know?
He's one of the few people who know how. Erasmus Niem is dead, and Griswold is busy guarding your friend. It has to be Vilar.
So what does he want with us?
I don't know.
Her eyes darted back and forth in thought. Then they widened.
Wait. You said no list of demands was found in the carriage.
No one but you appears to know anything about a list.
Makeda placed a cupped hand over her mouth in disbelief.
The list wasn't overlooked or blown away. He never left it. Everything makes sense now. Vilar didn't kidnap the Duchess to seek concessions. He never wanted a peaceful solution. He was only placating me, pretending. And now...
The bronze door ruptured. A stone fist punched through. Claws reached in and began ripping the hole wider. The metal screeched as it tore.
Raketa stuffed Jenny's note into Royce's hand.
Take this to the Duke.
What are you going to do? She looked back at the doors, and Royce couldn't tell if she was scared or angry.
Both, maybe.
Stop him, I hope. He's driving that thing, running it like a puppet. He can hear and see through it, so I can talk to him, reason with him.
The golem pushed in farther, and Royce dropped the hammer and sprinted for the stairs. The extra weight would only slow him down, and speed was what he needed now.
He took the steps three at a time.
Four flights up, he glanced back. Maketa remained in the middle of the main room next to a statue whose plaque read, Glenmorgan the Great. The gargoyle had opened the hole to the size of a window, and it was pulling its body through, emerging like some hideous insect splitting a pupa sac.
Fila! Maketa shouted.
She had both hands up, palms out.
Stop! You don't have to do this. I've talked to the Duchess. She's on our side and wants to help.
The creature appeared to be listening, or maybe it was merely having trouble getting through the ragged opening it had made. The bronze had left deep scratches across its stony skin.
I know you want your war, Vila. You think it's the only way, but it isn't. Jenny can get the Duke to change the laws, and they will force the guilds to change their rules. The Duchess was already working on it. The very night you kidnapped her, she was on her way back from...
Maketa stopped.
Oh, my Lord Feral.
She staggered, as if from a blow.
You knew, didn't you? You knew all along that she was working on a solution. That's why you did it. You wanted to stop her. You needed to stop her.
The gargoyle cleared the door. Using its feet and the knuckles of its hands, the thing scrambled monkey-like across the room. It slowed down as it neared her.
Maketa shook her head in disbelief.
Filar, how could you?
The golem hesitated for a moment, and Royce thought she had a chance. Then the thing sank both sets of claws into her body. Royce was no stranger to violence. He'd seen, he'd performed, brutalities that many would label gruesome, even sick. He was as used to bloodletting as a butcher, and yet what he witnessed in that artifact-filled chamber unsettled him.
It didn't so much vivisect Mercator as tear her open like a cloth bag with poor stitching.
Royce heard muscles shred, and her bones make a greenwood splinter sound. The Kalaenmir, whom Royce had only begun to know, and thought he might like, died in an explosion of blood that splattered the statue of Glenmorgan and stained the perfect marble floor. The gargoyle showed fangs and pointed teeth, grinning its delight. Then, as tears of blood ran down stone skin, that grotesque monkey face tilted up. No more encouragement was required. Royce resumed his rapid climb. The window on the top floor was his goal, his exit, the broken one Vilar had shattered the night before. Reaching the top floor, Royce once more spotted the suit of armor standing against the wall, still holding its long spear. Behind him, the gargoyle was climbing the steps. Royce listened to the crack of stone on marble, as if someone were clapping rocks together. Glass from the window still lay on the floor. Outside was the wall, the leap to the cathedral, and a trip across rooftops that Royce had made once already. Except this time, he would be the prey, the one who would slide down slate shingles and fall into the river. Maybe he, too, would survive. No, that sort of thing happens to other people, not me. He wasn't Vilar, and he wasn't competing with Amir.
With Royce's luck, the thing would embrace him in a bear hug, they'd hit the river, and he'd be dragged to the bottom. Supposed to retain the characteristics of the material they were made from. Remembering what had happened to the bust that Mercator had knocked off its pedestal, he grabbed the spear. Jerking it free of the armor, he positioned himself near the balcony's railing. "Hope this works," he thought, even though he suspected it wouldn't. "I still have the window," he consoled himself, "if I survive that long." Royce held the spear low, not in front, not braced against himself, just at his side. He didn't want to slam the beast head-on. Royce was certain if he tried that, the gargoyle would splinter the spear, or more likely drive it from his hands. He didn't want to stab the thing. He wanted to do what Hadrian had once achieved when facing an indestructible foe. Worked once. Might work again. But theory and reality were often distant relatives. After seeing what the golem had done to Mercator, Royce was less than confident. Watching a person being torn apart had that effect. "I don't have Hadrian's luck." The gargoyle's head rose above the steps as it climbed, its wings spread wide like the hood of a snake before a strike. It spotted Royce, and its eyes widened, the mouth displaying more teeth. Stone teeth. Stone face. Every inch of it was craggy and coarse and covered in rivulets of blood. The creature broke into a charge. The spear didn't give the monster the slightest pause. It didn't try to dodge, didn't shift or slow. The gargoyle appeared bemused, even joyful. Royce couldn't have had a more accommodating enemy, and imagined the golem felt the same way. As they came together, Royce planted his rear leg and held tight to the pole. Then, as they collided, he gave ground to prevent the gargoyle from jarring the spear from his hands. The impact was, nonetheless, powerful, and the tip broke. Royce fell back, dodging to one side while pushing against the stone beast, acting as a lever instead of an impediment. The golem's course altered, only 2 feet to one side, but it was enough. Shoved off balance, all its weight slammed into the balcony's railing. A man would have hit the balustrade and slid or bounced off. Supposed to retain the characteristics of the material they were made from. It may have wings, but stone can't fly. The heavy body of the charging gargoyle shattered the rail, and over the edge it went, crashing through the suspended body of the dragon, shattering the whole exhibit and sending it all to the floor 4 stories below. A bang, deep and solid, echoed off the walls, bouncing back and forth twice. "Shatter, you miserable figurine!" This half-thought, half-wish, filled Royce's mind as he peered over the edge. He hoped to see a burst of plaster, as when Mercator had overturned the bust. 4 stories down lay a mess of broken dragon parts, and the torn body of Mercator, her blood draining through a large crack in the checkered marble floor that marked the impact crater of the golem. The gargoyle hadn't been pulverized. The creature was on its knees in the center of the cracked floor. No, not Hadrian's kind of luck. Royce then noticed that the golem hadn't escaped unscathed. Part of it was missing. Its left arm lay on the floor a few feet away. The gargoyle looked at it mournfully. Then the fanged monkey face once more fixed its stare on Royce. This time it added a hiss. "Great. I've made it angry. Well, angrier." The golem ran for the stairs, and Royce raced for the window. Already knowing the route was his one comfort. The map was still engraved in his mind, which allowed Royce to move with speed and confidence. Poking his head out, he saw the street below. The avenue throbbed with a mass of people, some of whom wore uniforms and held torches. Bodies lay in a line, marking the golem's path to the gallery. Ducking past the remaining broken shards and out the window, Royce climbed up the wall.
He wished he'd brought his hand claws, but he hadn't had them the last time and had managed just fine. But I was the hunter then. Being the prey is a different matter.
Royce had been chased before. He never cared for it, and usually the hunt ended when he managed to gain enough distance to turn around unseen and don the role of huntsman once more. That wasn't going to happen this time.
How do you harm stone? He'd broken its arm by dropping it from a height. Perhaps taking a tumble from higher up?
Reaching the roof of the gallery, he looked back. Nothing but a single sheer curtain fluttered, blowing out through the broken window by an errant wind.
Is it possible the thing lost interest?
The answer came when the window's remnants burst outward and fell, along with portions of the frame and a few stones of the wall. More screams erupted below. Arms went up, fingers pointed, men shouted, "Up there! There it is!" The gargoyle wasn't as nimble as it had been when descending the cathedral. Climbing was clearly harder to manage with only one arm. Brute force now replaced grace. It fearlessly launched itself up from the sill, one clawed hand creating its own handhold, gouging out mortar like soft dirt. Rear claws did the same, then punched up again, stone muscles propelling it amazing distances in single thrusts. Royce didn't like the ease with which it followed, nor the power it displayed. Mercator's death remained fresh in his mind, and he didn't want to be anywhere near those claws.
Taking a cue from the previous night, he pulled slate shingles free and threw, hoping he might make the golem fall.
Royce's aim was better than Vilar's, and he struck the beast three times, once in the head, twice in the body. The slates shattered. The gargoyle didn't notice.
How am I going to make it fall again?
The question was pushed aside as he realized it didn't matter. Not yet. He needed to get higher. Royce resumed his flight. Running out along the gable, he jumped the gap between the gallery and Grumgallimus, landing on a stony lion's head. Below him, he heard the crowd cheer with excitement. As he scaled the cathedral's pier, Royce realized how futile the effort was. Even if he got away from the golem, reached the Duke, somehow convinced him his wife was alive, and persuaded the man to concede to Mercator's demands, Hadrian might still die. The issue of Nim's death hadn't yet been addressed. If Hadrian's luck provided him the means to slip free of that noose, Royce just might kill him anyway. They were up six stories now. Is that enough? No, I need to go higher. After Royce reached the flying buttress, obtaining additional height was no longer an issue. He ran up its angled length, and the world below dropped away as he climbed several stories as quickly as ascending stairs. Reaching the high balcony just below the cathedral's eaves, Royce saw it as a death trap. Too narrow to pull another spear stunt, even if he had one. Up there, the golem would have all the advantage. Facing the thing on the steep roof of Grumgallimus wasn't to Royce's liking. The peak was equally dangerous for both. The battle odds would be even. Each had a good chance of falling. Royce was never pleased with a fair fight. But fair was better than certain death. They were about 250 feet up, and he guessed his odds of surviving a fall, assuming he could hit the water, were 1 in 100. Vilar had managed it. Hadrian could probably pull it off as well, but I don't have his kind of luck.
Royce saw it as a last resort.
Reaching up, he grabbed the eaves, scowling at the row of gargoyle faces that glared down at him. Each one, he now realized, was grinning.
I really hate these things.
Royce was breathing hard, his clothes stuck to his skin, and as he pulled himself up, he realized his muscles were weakening.
Stone, he guessed, doesn't get tired.
As he reached the roof, the wind greeted him with a familiar blast of cold air. He replied with a grunt and a scowl, as he was forced to remember that spring, while very near, hadn't yet arrived. The chill sent a shiver through him, and whipped what was left of his cloak over his shoulder. Below, he spotted the golem racing up the buttress, wings extended like an acrobat's balancing pole. When crouched, and seen at a distance on the walls of buildings, gargoyles appeared small. Up close, the creature was 8 feet tall.
This isn't going to end well. Royce shimmied up the ribs to the fence-like peak of the roof, where he would make his last stand.
His options were limited. He could try to climb the bell tower, as Vilar had considered doing, but there was no more benefit in it now than before. He could climb down the other side of the cathedral, and hope the golem would follow and fall, the way Vilar had. Already tired, Royce knew if anyone fell, it would most likely be him. Each step inched him toward exhaustion, while the gargoyle showed no sign of weakening.
The thing lost its arm! If I lost one after falling 4 stories, I'd quit. It hasn't even slowed down.
Royce had to make a move while he still had the strength. The golem was one-handed now, and needed both feet to stand on the roof, so it couldn't rip him apart as it had Mercator. The thing would have to resort to slashing, biting, or crushing. But without a spear, without a weapon, fighting the golem would be suicide, except...
Royce pulled Alverstone from the folds of his cloak. Moonlight gave its blade a luminosity that was pleasantly eerie.
Royce had few possessions. The dagger was his most prized, for 2 reasons. The first was that it had been a gift from a man who'd shown him kindness and saved his life. The only one to do so. Until Hadrian acted the fool on the Crown Tower. The second was that the blade was remarkable. He had no idea how it had been created. The weapon had somehow been forged in secret in that infernal pit that was the Menzant prison and salt mine. The one good thing to come out of there?
No, Royce corrected himself. Not the only good thing.
The dagger wasn't the real gift he'd received. It was but a symbol, the embodiment of something more. The gleeful, thieving assassin who entered that salt mine wasn't the same as the one who'd crawled out. As Royce straddled the peak of Gromgallimus, waiting for the arrival of the golem, what he held in his hand wasn't a dagger. It was what it always had been. Hope.
He didn't wait long. The gargoyle leapt onto the roof, and once more grinned with delight to find his prey waiting.
With his other hand holding on to the decorative iron fins along the roof's peak, Royce braced in a crouch, facing into the howling wind.
Is this the craziest, stupidest thing I've ever done?
That this was even a question made him suspect the idiocy of his past life choices. Using the stone claws on its feet, the gargoyle pinched into the slate, creating firm footholds as it walked up the steep slope. A gust of wind hit its wings, staggering and nearly toppling the beast, but the creature folded them away and continued its climb.
This is what Vilar had seen last night. An unstoppable predator. Irony. Oh, how I hate thee.
Royce maintained his perch along the line of the peak. When the first attack came, a wide swipe from the remaining arm, he shuffled back along the length. All this did was grant the gargoyle room to take position on the ridgeline with him. With only one arm, the golem couldn't both attack and hold on to the fins. Still, it had claws on its feet and, of course, fangs.
Royce couldn't forget the fangs.
Mercator's blood was already drying, aided by the brisk wind. An ever-present, sinisterly sculpted smile revealed zigzagging teeth as pointed as spear tips. The invention of an artist with a sick mind and no concern for realism. The gargoyle moved forward with the confidence Royce lacked. Facing the monster, guarding from attacks, Royce shuffled backward blindly, knowing he would eventually run out of roof and do so without warning. He was a sailor walking a plank backward.
Royce dodged a swipe from the golem's foot. In the process, he backed up too far and found the end of the roof. He fell, catching himself by grabbing the decorative ironwork. The golem pressed the advantage, rushing forward. With Royce dangling and nearly helpless, the sensible thing for the golem to do would have been to crush his hand and let him fall. Instead, it grabbed his wrist and jerked him up. The golem's grip on his wrist was exactly what Royce expected, vice-strong and cold.
This was the end of the fight. But while the golem had but one arm, Royce had two.
As the golem jerked Royce up, it had no defense, likely didn't feel a need for it.
How do you harm stone?
The golem had no reason to fear a delicate dagger.
Royce had slim hope himself, despite knowing the weapon was endowed with an extraordinary blade that cut wood like hot iron cut wax. Once, it had even cut a link of iron chain. Alverstone was hope in the face of despair, and Royce hoped very hard as he jabbed at the gargoyle's chest.
Rather than turn, deflect, or snap, as it should have, the dagger's blade punctured the stone, not deep. It didn't have the opportunity. The golem screamed, recoiled, and in that instant of shock, the heavy stone creature was thrown off balance. Falling from its precarious perch, the golem let go of Royce in the hope of grabbing support. Released from bondage, Royce fell. He hit the roof's surface, started his slide, and, without thought, used Alverstone the way he so often used his hand claws. Royce stabbed into the slate with the blade. It penetrated, caught, and held, leaving Royce hanging from the dagger. As beside him, the golem tumbled. The gargoyle's weight worked against it. It managed to grab an edge, but tore it free. The one-time statue fell, rolled, and picked up the sort of speed one expects from a rock rolling down a steep roof. It bounced, jumped, and finally fell, this time on the plaza side. The gargoyle's wings spread, but stone wings did nothing to slow its fall.
Royce didn't see the impact. The edge of the roof blocked the climax.
He heard it. A loud crack. Screams and shouts followed. They were short-lived, the sort that came from the surprise of a falling stone, rather than the fear of a living golem.
Chapter 21 The Duke. The bronze doors of the Imperial Gallery, one with a massive hole torn in it, were open by the time Royce reached the street. A skittish crowd remained in the plaza, and given the way they scuttled back at his approach, they had watched his upper-story jiggery-pokery. That was most certainly what Evelyn would have made of his chase across the rooftops, if she'd been in the crowd. Royce considered for a moment whether she'd been one of those people the gargoyle had injured in its murderous march across the plaza. No one would have fared well before the golem's onslaught, but an old woman would lack any ability to get out of the way. His teeth clenched in anger. He didn't know why. He hated that old woman. He took a breath before entering the gallery, and then another. He'd just survived a race with a golem, and felt he deserved to take a moment. His back was sore, and his wrist ached where the stone monster had held onto it. But at least it wasn't broken. Not exactly Hadrian's luck, but better than his normal lot. Few spectators had found the courage to venture inside. Those who did hugged the wall nearest the exit. A handful of men dressed in the uniform of the Duke's city guard made a semicircle around the bloody mess in the middle of the rotunda. Most stood awkwardly, shifting their weight, unsure where to look or what to do. three others pulled back the broken remains of the fallen dragon, revealing the extent of the gore. Everything within 20 feet of Maketa's body wept blood. The remains bore as little resemblance to a once living person as did a slab of bacon. A young man, in a crisp new set of clothing, clapped both hands over his mouth. When that didn't work, he ran for the door, brushing past Royce in his dash to the street. As a general rule, Royce disliked everyone. Strangers began at a deficit that required they prove their worth just to be seen as neutral. Maketa had jumped that bar in record time. And a mirror to boot, he thought. How remarkable is that? Royce couldn't help feeling he'd blindly brushed past greatness. An opportunity had been lost. A treasure squandered. That was how he framed it in his head, as an abstract business failure. But looking at Mercator's blood and the blue-stained lumps of meat that had once been the most remarkable mirror he'd ever known, Royce clenched his fists. A shriveled-up biddy, and now a mirror. I'm becoming soft. This is all Hadrian's fault. You there! One of the guards shouted. Grab him! Not twice in one night, Royce thought as he took a step back, dipping into a crouch. The guard wasn't a fool. He recognized the body language, which must have looked like a badger raising its fur, teeth bared. The man didn't rush him. Neither did anyone else. Instead, the guards fanned out. Royce heard movement behind him. Turning, he found himself face to face with Roland Wyberg, just coming in through the torn bronze door. Well, it's about time, Royce said. Come on. We gotta go. Go? What are you talking about? Where's Hadrian? Roland asked, puzzled. He looked at the hole in the door, then at the bloody mess in the center of the room. What in Novron's name happened here?
I saw this man running across the rooftops, chased by...
The guard faltered.
Chased by whom?
Roland asked. His stare extended to everyone in the room. Finally settling on Royce. Not a who, a what, Royce replied. One of the stone gargoyles from the walls of Grom Gallimus.
A gargoyle?
Roland asked, pronouncing the word with distinct incredulity. Royce nodded. A stone statue, normally content to sit on a ledge outside the cathedral, decided to climb down. It took a particular dislike to myself and... His eyes tracked to the blood pool. A mirror named Mercata Sicara. Roland stared. He opened his mouth. It hung there for a moment. Then he closed it again, his eyes shifting helplessly.
I don't know what to make of that.
Luckily, I do, Royce said. He pulled out two parchments.
Here. This one's for you. It's from Hadrian, explaining why you need to take me and Mercator to the Duke and insist on an audience, although now we'll have to settle for just me. And the other?
Roland pointed at the parchment but made no attempt to take it. This guy's a lot smarter than I gave him credit for. And that's good because whether either of us likes it or not, we're about to become a team.
This?
Royce held up the letter from Jenny Winter.
If we're lucky, it's a weapon we can use to prevent a slaughter tomorrow.
Roland continued to look puzzled. Then realization dawned.
The Feast of Nobles?
Exactly. We need to see the Duke. Right now. Governor's Isle was an odd name for the ancestral residence of dukes. But Royce guessed it had something to do with all that gibberish Evelyn had blathered on about. The place didn't look anything like a ducal castle. The estate had the typical ugly wall surrounding the grounds. But it appeared out of place, newer and more slapdash than anything inside, all of which was extraordinarily precise. Brick paths wound through open lawns and alongside trimmed hedges. One led through a small orchard and garden to a stable